All right, we are going to be continuing in our look at marriage, divorce, and remarriage. We're in the subsection of the marriage and the bond, and looking at the implications and the consequences of the fact that married and bound are not always the same thing. We looked at who can marry, that is, who has a scriptural right. We've looked at who cannot marry, looked at what are sexual immorality and adultery, and we've looked at does not under bondage mean free to marry, and we've seen what the Bible has to say about all of those topics, and you can find the tapes. I believe Chris is getting them on the website there, so if you missed some of those, you want to go back and review, they're all there. I have the material as well in PowerPoints if you'd like to get those. But we're looking at now, can the innocent party remarry if the guilty one does? That is, someone who's been put away, but it wasn't for fornication, if the one that put them away then marries, then becomes an adulterer according to the doctrine, can the one who was left behind then marry because this one went into adultery? It's typically called mental divorce. There's another phrase I've found that describes it without giving kind of a negative connotation. That is the post-civil divorce putting away. And the idea is exactly that. It's a civil divorce. It's something that men have allowed to happen, but it hasn't been seen as a divorce in God's eyes. If it hasn't been, can the one who was divorced in the civil courts then put away in God's courts the one who did the divorcing unlawfully? That's the question we're looking at. So we'll call it mental divorce for convenience's sake, and we don't mean to imply that it is just some sort of mental game that's going on, but that it is an issue that takes place in the mind of the believer in the law of God. We're looking now at the counter issues and counter arguments. We've looked at the doctrine itself quite a bit in the last couple of weeks. And so what we're looking at, what we began to look at last time, is this unscriptural divorce argument. It's the argument that when you put someone away not for fornication, that's an unscriptural divorce. It's not a real divorce, or it's not accepted, or it's not seen by God as an actual divorce. And so this divorce not for fornication is called unscriptural. The argument is made that it's not real, but it's only a divorce in the accommodative sense. It's only a divorce because that's what men call it. That's what the law of our land says, and that's man's law, not God's. Since we're under God's law, one who's been put away unscripturally, that is, that was put away without being a fornicator, then has a right still to a scriptural or a real divorce in certain circumstances. If the one who put them away remarries, then they can remarry without sin. And the question is that what's taught by the scriptures, the actual scriptures on marriage and divorce? Do they make this distinction? That's the basis here, is this distinction between what man's law does and what God's law does. And that's what we focused on last time, is that man's law or God's law that's being looked at in the scriptures that deal with marriage, divorce, and remarriage. In every one of the scriptures we looked at, Matthew 5, we began Jesus on the Sermon on the Mount, speaking of God's righteousness versus man's. He says earlier in the chapter of Matthew 5, unless your righteousness exceeds the righteousness of the Pharisees and the scribes, you by no means enter into the kingdom of heaven. He's talking about the way God would have things do in his establishment. And when he gets to Matthew 5, 31 and 32, he really denounces their abuse of God's law. They have been saying, just put a writ of divorce in her hand. They were citing Deuteronomy 24, and that'll make any divorce okay. He said that's not the case, because what ends up happening is three people end up in adultery. The one who did the divorcing and remarries, the one who was left behind and remarries, and the one who married her, according to Matthew 5, 31 and 32. So their abuse of God's law ended up resulting in adultery. In Matthew 19 and in Mark 10, the Pharisees came and asked, is it lawful to put away your spouse for just any reason? They wanted to know, what does God's law say about this? They were trying Jesus. They weren't actually trying to rest on the law as such. They were trying to play him and see if they could get him in trouble. But they came up with this question, is it according to God's law? And they cited Deuteronomy 24. In Luke 16, also a Pharisee is involved. That's why I lumped those together. And God mentions in Luke 16, 18 this idea of this divorce and remarrying and the resulting adulteries that come about because of it. The point is, as Jesus taught God's law to the Pharisees, as he responded to their questions, as he showed their hypocrisies, he said, in God's law, what you're doing amounts to adultery, is what it comes down to. You're creating adulterous situations. And then in Romans chapter 7 and 1 Corinthians 7 is what's hidden there, In both those cases where Paul speaks of the law of God, he's talking about the marriage law, and speaking of people who know the law, he's talking of God's law, and he's applying it in those specific situations. So in none of the verses that we have dealing with marriage, divorce, and remarriage in the New Testament do we have a distinction, man's law or God's law. It's always talking about God's law. In fact, what we established early in our study was that all of these are based on the original law of God that came from Genesis chapter 2. That was the first way that Jesus responded when they asked about divorce. He didn't even start with Moses in Deuteronomy. He started with God in Genesis and gave God's law. So the scriptures don't make this distinction that's being made. And my point is that this unscriptural divorce argument does not begin with the scripture itself. It begins with a supposition that there's an innocent person that should have rights. And so if you just read the scripture, it's an unnatural position is what I'm trying to maintain here, because that distinction is not visibly made in the scripture. It's an assumption or it's a presumption that comes out. Now, what we're going to look at today is the reason why that presumption comes along, why that presupposition comes along. It's an argument that says men cannot divorce. Only God can do it. And this is a pretty convincing argument. It's showing, again, this fact that God's law reigns supreme, especially in the minds and hearts of those who submit to Him. And so men cannot divorce. So it's attempting to establish the reason that not all divorces are seen as real, accepted, or scriptural, or in God's eyes, or any of those myriad phrases that say this wasn't a true divorce, but only an accommodative divorce. And it's based in Jesus' teaching on God's marriage law. It goes right back to Genesis 2, verse 24. Therefore, what God has joined together, let not man separate. Matthew 19:6, Mark 10:9, both of those. Jesus says that very clearly. He makes that conclusion off of Genesis 2:24. He says, this is what God intended from the beginning, and since God has put them together, no man should separate them. Let not man separate. It's God who did it. How can man undo it? And so he uses that phrase there, let not. And we'll look at that in detail today. And the point of the argument is that God separates only fornicators. Those are the only ones who really have a broken bond. That's what he says when he says, except it be for fornication. What God means is that's the only case where he will break the bond. Any other way, man cannot separate. And so unless it was for fornication, there's been no divorce. That's the argument. What we need to see is if that's what the scriptures maintain. I wanted to delineate the argument. I didn't put the people's names up here. These are actual quotes from people that call themselves Christians, from brethren of ours. And I wanted to share these with you. If you'd like to know who said it, I can tell you later. I didn't think it fit the purposes of our particular class. I put the references so you can find them on your own if you would like. But here's what's said. When an innocent woman is divorced, this divorce is, in the sight of God, no divorce. He does not recognize it. The innocent woman is still married in God's sight, and the husband who divorced her is still married to her in God's sight. Their marriage has not been dissolved, and as far as God is concerned, she is not put away. And the Greek word for put away there is apoluo, or apoluo, however you say that. That is the word that's used in Matthew 19 and Mark 10. When her husband remarried, he committed adultery. I contend that the innocent may then put away her husband. Reason? That is exactly what Christ said she could do. This is what the argument says, and it looks like that's what it says in Matthew 19 and verse 6. Here's more. As far as God is concerned, one is not divorced except it be for fornication. That's what we were stating before. This is someone else. This is their argument as they're laying it out, again, in the gospel anchor there. Remember, to deny this divine right, the divine right of putting the fornicator away after they've put you away, to such a person on the grounds of her already being a put-away person, overlooks the fact that that original putting away, such putting away, is futile. Only God can really do that. And so what you're doing is dethroning divine authority and enthroning human authority. You're saying man's courts have more importance than God's. And this was one of our first points that we brought out, one of the first major consequences. If you don't believe this argument, then you're making man's law more important than God's law. That's one of the things that's held up as a reason why this must be true. Now, these are good points that are made supporting this argument, and here's the final one I'll share with you today. There's several more, and if you'd like to see more of these, just get in contact with me. I can find some for you. And so In conclusion from this, we learn that an unscriptural divorce releases neither party from marriage. When you have an unscriptural divorce, as men count it, it's not so with God. That bond is still intact, and that little piece of paper is nothing in the sight of God. Just as well use it as Kleenex and blow your nose and drop it in the toilet. Doesn't mean a thing to God. God's law rules over the laws of men. This was someone who preached this, and this was later recorded and written down. Now, I will agree with that phrase right there. That bond is still intact. The difference is there's also this question of the marriage, and that's exactly the context we're in. Is the marriage the same as the bond? We've already studied on that issue, and we determined that it wasn't, that it's not. But in this argument, it has to be. And this is how it happens. And it seems like a very subtle thing, but it's very important. The marriage has not been dissolved. Neither party was released from the marriage, is what's argued. And that bond is still intact. The bond is still intact. That's true. That where I take issue is this question here. And what we'll look at is this issue of the marriage. Now, let's look at the conclusions as they're summarized. Here's what's being said, basically. If it's not lawful, then it's not legitimate. It can't be done. If it's not something that's approved, it hasn't actually happened. If it's not something that's permitted, and here's the question, if it's not something that God permits, let not man separate what God has joined together, then it's not possible really to do it. Only God can do it. And if it's not right, then it's not real. And we'll look at that later on. Is it a real marriage then when this man divorced his wife for no fornication and went off and married somebody else? That's not a real marriage. He's in adultery. And so that gives her the right then to divorce from him, put him away. Well, again, we'll ask the question, does this let not give us all that leeway we just saw that was based on this let not? Is this what is taught by the scriptures on marriage and divorce? To look at that, I thought we'd look at several things first. I want to first look at this phrase in the different versions, the way that the different translators have translated it. What we're used to is seeing this, let not man put asunder. That's the American Standard. It's the Darby version, King James. This is the one we grew up hearing. Let not man put asunder what God hath joined together. Let not that which has been joined by God be parted by man. That's interesting. Bible in basic English. Here's the Bishop's Bible from 1500s. Let not man therefore put asunder that which God hath coupled together. All of these are still using that phrase, let not, but we're going to start seeing a change in some of these other versions. Look at this. This is no more let not, it's and no one should separate a couple that God has joined together. Now that seems to have a whole different meaning. It's the same Greek words, but the contemporary English version and all the German versions have this same exact phraseology. It's should instead of don't. Should not is the idea. And then, what I like about this is all those said man, but the word in Greek is really general. It means human being. So no one, and here even more general, no human being must separate then what God has joined together. Or any human being must not separate, if you want to turn it around, then what God has joined together. That's the Good News Bible. And then, therefore, don't let anyone separate what God has joined together. These are all translations of the same verse there, Matthew 19:6, and then Mark 10:9 says the same thing. And it's just kind of interesting how the scholars chose to translate that let not phrase. This is an older style of English. Obviously, when you get to the contemporary English version, it's a little different here. It doesn't mean that it changed the meaning. It still means the same thing it meant then. But it may be clearer to us what's actually being said here. This is not a prohibition, as if it's an impossibility. But let's look at it. Later on, let's look at it this way to make sure that what we're talking about is the same thing. First off, did Jesus mean that man cannot separate or that he should not separate what God has joined? The argument is made that Jesus is saying that it cannot be done. If it's not for fornication, there is no way to have this divorce and be proper in God's eyes. Cannot do it. But if you think about it, why would Jesus say, don't do it, if man couldn't do it anyway? Why would that be necessary? Why would he have to say, don't let anyone do this thing, if it was an impossibility? And what happens, though, with the argument is that there's a confusion between the marriage and the bond, and so people begin to see this marital relationship as what's still binding on them. And it's not, it's the binding by God that's binding. Yes, God is the only one who can break the bond. You can break the relationship. and that's what people do all the time. But the bond itself, God can only break. And so what the root of their point is correct. It's the language they use that gets them into trouble, and then they try to force it on another half of the argument, and that's what ends up bringing the problem somewhere. Here it is. The divorce releases neither party from marriage. That's not true. The divorce is absolutely releasing people from a marriage, from a relationship. It doesn't release them from the bond, which is why I said I agree with the second part here. That's what confusion happens, and then once that confusion has happened, the rest of the argument follows that confusion. Now, Bob is talking about something that I haven't heard, that he makes the distinction. So, I mean, I'm curious to see how the argument goes from there, and we'll have an opportunity to examine that. But let me at least work through this let not question here. So Jesus does say they can separate the marriage. The fact that Jesus commands not to separate indicates that man does have the power to do so. God doesn't permit him to. God doesn't want him to. God condemns him for doing it, but he can do it. And we see instances of it in the Bible. We see instances of it all around us, that people do dissolve marriages. And so what we need to understand about God's law is the way it works. God's law teaches man what he should not do, not what's impossible for him to do. There'd be no reason to put the law there. If man could not sin, why tell him what sin is? Romans chapter 2, verses 12 and 13 speaks of people who were sinning even under the law. They had the law, they knew what it said, they still chose not to follow it. He's talking about the Jews specifically. As many as have sinned without law will perish without law. As many have sinned in the law will be judged by the law. For not the hearers of the law are just in the sight of God, but the doers. So the law is given for you to do what it says, not to do what it says not to do, but some do. Then Galatians 3 says it was added because of transgressions. And the whole point is to keep people from transgressing. And that meant that they could. They had to learn to do what was right and to do it. Well, there are several times this phrase, not let or let not, is used. And I've got a New King James that I put these quotes in from. So to find the let not, I had to go back and look at the American Standard and King James. But these are several of these, just to make sure that we understand. When you do a charitable deed, do not let not your left hand know what your right hand is doing. Is that an impossibility? Well, no. The idea is you shouldn't be trumpeting it in the context. Don't even let your left hand know what your right hand's doing. It's a should not. Those who are in Judea, remember this is in the context of the destruction of Jerusalem. Those who are in Judea, flee to the mountains. Let those who are in the midst of her depart, and let not those who are in the country enter her. Well, they could if they wanted to, but that would be a really bad decision. It's not an impossibility to go back to Judea. You just don't want to because you're going to die if you do. So it's a should not. And again, it's that phrase. Let not your heart be troubled. You believe in God, believe also in me. Well, they were troubled when he said it. So that meant they could. He was saying that. Don't be troubled. You shouldn't be troubled. You do believe in God. You should believe in me. So again, it was a should not. I've got several of these. But again, let not your heart be troubled, neither let it be afraid, in John 14:27. Therefore, do not let, the American Standard says, therefore let not sin reign in your mortal body, that you should obey it in its lust. It's interesting, the other half is a should, and that's exactly the point. You shouldn't let sin make you obey it. You can avoid that. Let not him who eats despise him who does not eat, and let not him who does not eat judge him who eats. So again, something you shouldn't be judging the other. God has received them. And in this context, don't let your good be spoken of as evil. Let not your good be spoken of as evil. Don't go eating meats that were sacrificed to idols just because you believe it's okay if you're making someone else sin because they don't believe it's okay and they do it anyway. Be angry, do not sin. Let not the sun go down on your wrath. It could, but you shouldn't let it. You should take care of things before then. Don't let the widows be a burden to the church. Well, they could be. Let not that man suppose he will receive anything from the Lord. In James chapter 1, verse 7, the man who prays double-mindedly, he's not saying it's impossible for him to feel that way. He's just saying you shouldn't. You shouldn't imagine you're going to receive anything. And again, yeah, I've just had to get through it. We're now to the verses that were important, though. Let not man separate. It doesn't mean that he can't. It means he shouldn't. Well, let's consider then a few ideas that go along with this. First, God condemns murder, but he doesn't keep it from happening. It does happen. He condemns prostitution, yet it happens. He condemns fornication, yet it happens, and obviously he condemns unlawful divorce, but he's not made it impossible to attain one. All these are working on this same argument. He does not impede unlawful divorce, and so there are people that are in those situations. But let's look at what marriage is as they're spoken of in the Bible. And I can see that what the direction we're going to have to go eventually with this is, again, back to the concept of the marriage or the bond. Marriages in the Bible can be right or they can be wrong. You can be married to someone you don't have a right to be married to. We will look later at the case of Herod. He obviously was in a wrong marriage. They can be approved or unapproved. It's the same thing as right or wrong, as we looked at there. These phrases we're not going to find. Someone's not going to say you're in a right marriage or a wrong marriage. But what I'm trying to get at is that what we're trying to say are these things: whether God has approved of it or has not approved of this marital relationship, whether it's lawful or unlawful. That's the phrase that's most thrown around, and we do see marriages that are in both of those cases. In fact, that's the one that John the Baptist will say to Herod, it is unlawful. And then either they're permitted by God or they're prohibited by God. What's said so often, though, is not the case. We don't see marriages that are real or unreal. When the word marriage is used, it denotes people that have a marital relationship, not just an imagined marital relationship, not just in the courts of men, but God says it's a marriage. They have a relationship. And so we have to understand that it's there. It's not actual or apparent. There's no difference in God's eyes or in man's eyes. It's a marriage. God recognized it as a marriage. What do we do with that? Well, let's look at this marriage of Herod and Herodias. Mark chapter 6. Mark chapter 6, obviously we know the story here of where John has been beheaded, and we're kind of getting the retrospective on what happened to John. Somebody read for us there verses 14 through 18 in Mark chapter 6. We'd like to read that for us. George, got that? Thank you.
Now King Herod heard of him, for his name had become well known. And he said, John the Baptist is risen from the dead, and therefore these powers are at work in him. Others said it is Elijah, and others said it is a prophet or like one of the prophets. But when Herod heard, he said, this is John whom I beheaded. He has been raised from the dead. Herod himself had sent and laid hold of John and bound him in prison for the sake of Herodias, his brother Philip's wife, for he had married her. Because John had said to Herod, it is not lawful for you to have your brother's wife.
Now there we see that actual phrase, it is not lawful. There's an unlawful marriage. But what does he say about him? Well, we see that Herodias is still considered his brother Philip's wife. That's the way she's described here. Now, sounds like they're in a married relationship, but they're not. We see from this, they're not married anymore. This term is used describing one who belongs to the other. And we'll look at this word wife in just a moment as well. But it says that Herod had married this other person's wife. And so John said, that's not lawful. Well, whose law is he talking about? We looked at this a while back. He's talking about God's marital law. You don't have a right to be with someone who belongs to someone else. And he describes that. It's not lawful for you to have your brother's wife. She belongs to another man. What you're doing is against God's law. Again, in our sub-point here, even though it was not right or approved or lawful or permitted, it's still a marriage. That's the term that's used for it, married. And the description, you have your brother's wife. There's a relationship going on. He doesn't say anything about being bound. He just says they are married. The relationship exists. It is a real marriage. Now, let's look at the way the word wife is used in the Bible. We won't look at all of these verses, but wife is used, and it's a general word, both in the Greek and the Hebrew. It's a word that means woman. This is one of those words that causes problems over in 1 Timothy chapter 3 when people want to talk about deacons' wives and presbyters' wives, pastors' wives, as though they're a position in the church. Well, when Jesus makes his clarification of these texts, he describes what happened. He describes the man leaving his father and mother and cleaving to his wife, and then he describes God joining them. And so the three-step process, if you will, is there. The part that man does and the part that God does is would be the third step, would be God's doing. We don't see the details of that here, but Jesus details that for us in the New Testament. All we see here is this general word woman, which we'll look at that in our last point up here. But it just says he was joined to his woman. And then that word, you take it in context, whether it's someone he's bound to or married to or what it is. And that's what we're looking at here. Sometimes this very general word woman meant someone's concubine. In all of these cases, we'll look at let's look at Genesis 25 and 1 Chronicles there, just to see in general how this word is used. Genesis 25 verse 1 and then verses 5 and 6. This is Abraham again took a wife, and her name was Keturah, and the word used here is wife. Then verses 5 and 6, Abraham gave all that he had to Isaac, gave gifts to the sons of the concubines which Abraham had. While he was still living, he sent them eastward away from Isaac his son to the country of the east. He had several concubines here. And then 1 Chronicles 1:32, just to pick up the second half of this point. The sons born to Keturah, Abraham's concubine, were Zimran, Jokshan, Midian, Ishbak, and Shua. Sons of Jokshan were Sheba and Dedan. So she's called his wife in Genesis 25. She's called his concubine in 1 Chronicles. It's the same woman, same person here, and that word, that general word, is used for both of those descriptions. A betrothed person, we see several instances of that. Let's look at Deuteronomy 22. Somebody read for us there in Deuteronomy 22, verses 23 and 24.
If a young woman who is a virgin is betrothed to a husband, and a man finds her in the city and lies with her, then you shall bring them both out to the gate of that city, and you shall stone them to death with stones. The young woman, because she did not cry out in the city, and the man, because he humbled his neighbor's wife, so you shall put away the evil from among you.
So she's betrothed, she's a virgin in verse 23, yet she's called a wife here in verse 24. The idea is she belongs already to somebody. This betrothal process, that's something else we can get into at some point if you would like to, but the betrothal process was seen as tantamount to the marriage. You remember that Joseph and Mary, he had been minded to put her away secretly, though the indications are they were only betrothed. That's what we see in the New Testament. But a betrothed person is also called a wife. Certainly a bride. Judges 14. Somebody find those verses and read for it. Judges 14, verses 15 and 16, and again verse 20. Judges 14, verses 15, 16, and 20.
So he said to them, out of the eater came something to eat, and out of the strong came something sweet. Now for 3 days they could not explain the riddle. But it came to pass on the seventh day, they said to Samuel's wife, entice your husband, that he may explain the riddle to us, or else we will burn you and your father's house with fire. Have you invited us in order to take what is ours? Is that not so? In verse 20. And Samson's wife was given to his companions, who had been his best man.
So this is during the wedding feast, actually, during this wedding week or whatever they've got going on, that all these things are happening. And so she's actually his bride, though she's seen as his wife here and called his wife. She's not; they're not officially married, as far as the story would tell. So she ends up going and being with one of the best men after this. A widow is called a wife in lots of different places there, in the sense that it's remembering the man she had been with. She was a man's woman and therefore his wife. Let's look at 2 Samuel 2, 3 and 11 there. 2 Samuel 2:2, and then 3:3, and 11:26. Look at those three verses. Joe, would you read those three for us? Do you mind? 2 Samuel 2:2.
So David went up there, and his two wives also, Ahinoam the Jezreelitess, and Abigail the widow of Nabal the Carmelite.
Yeah, she's called his wife though, and the widow here is actually from Nabal. I got that verse incorrect. 3:3 is
okay.
The next one.
His second Chilia by Abigail, the widow of Nabal the Carmelite. The third, Absalom, the son of Maacah, the daughter of Talmai, king of Geshur.
Yeah, so she's still seen as the widow of Nabal the Carmelite, though she is the wife now that belongs to David. And then in 11:26 of 2 Samuel.
When the wife of Uriah heard that Uriah, her husband, was dead, she mourned for her husband.
Obviously, she's not his wife in the sense that they're still married. He's dead. She's not bound to him anymore, but she's mourning for him, and she's still called his wife, accommodatively, if you will, there. But here's the one that's interesting to see, is this one who is married to another, and that's, we see that a lot in the New Testament. You see several verses there. Obviously, wife, as Bobby pointed out, was used the first time there in Genesis 2:24. We'll look at that marital commitment at some point as well. We still need to determine when does a marriage, and when is a divorce. We'll have to look at that in these contexts as well. But one who is married to another, in Judges 15, going back there, verses 1 and 2, after a while, in the time of wheat harvest, it happened that Samson visited his wife with a young goat. And he said, "Let me go into my wife, into her room," but her father would not permit him to go in. Her father said, "I really thought that you thoroughly hated her, therefore I gave her to your companion. Is not her younger sister better than she? Please take her instead." And she's already married to someone else, yet he's calling her his wife. That's the way he sees her. 1 Samuel 25:44. What we're looking at is the fact that this word for woman that is translated wife often describes a woman in various circumstances. 1 Samuel 25:44. Saul had given Michal, his daughter, David's wife, to Palti, the son of Laish, who was from Galim. And then we'll see some in the New Testament. In Matthew 14, because we've been looking at Hebrew words for the most part there, but we'll see that the same thing holds true in the Greek. Matthew 14, and I didn't put the words up here this time. We did a thorough word study before, one of our earlier studies. Matthew 14, verses 3 and 4. Somebody read those for us. This is the same context of what we've been looking at in Mark 6. Matthew 14, verses 3 and 4.
"For Herod had laid hold of John and bound him and put him in prison for the sake of Herodias, his brother Philip's wife, because John had said to him, 'It is not lawful for you to have her.'"
Again, that's what we saw in Mark. Let's look at 1 Corinthians 5. The account in the Gospels is that Herodian and Herodias account. 1 Corinthians 5, verse 1. Again, a man... It's actually reported there is sexual immorality among you, and such sexual immorality is not even named among the Gentiles, that a man has his father's wife. There's debate about whether that means that the father was still married to the woman, or this man who was in this incestuous relationship had then married the father's wife. But at any rate, she's one who's married to another, and she's used, this term wife is used to describe her. It's a very general word, is the point. Then when we see it in 1 Corinthians 7, we looked at these verses already. We see wife used here. We see husband used a couple of times. But as Paul is saying, "To the married I command, yet not I but the Lord, a wife is not to depart from her husband. But even if she does depart," again, this is that idea, let not, but if it happens. It is not an impossibility. "When she does depart from her husband, whatever the reason, she's unmarried." And the word is divorced. And so, again, been told I'm beating a dead horse already, but the point of all this particular lesson is to show that these are true divorces and they're true dissolution of marriage. Now, one of the main points of this post-civil divorce put away is this idea that marriage hasn't been dissolved. And so the question remains, how do you look at it in this one verse in Matthew 19:9? What does he mean? What is he saying when he says whoever divorces and whoever marries and whoever marries her who was divorced? How does he mean it? Does he mean they were really divorced, or does he mean they weren't? The first time he says it, "I say to you," this is Matthew 19:9, "I say to you, whoever divorces his wife except for sexual immorality." Let's presume that what he's saying is whoever divorces and it wasn't sexual immorality. That's the possibility he's opening up here. Was it a real divorce or was it not? Well, it is a real divorce. The marriage is broken. If he puts her away, he has broken the marital covenant, the marital relationship. Now, it doesn't matter whether it was for sexual immorality or not. Jesus is opening up both possibilities when he says, unless it be for this, which means it could be not for this also. But if he does it and it's not for this and marries another, well, can he really marry someone else? Well, yes, he can. Because he really divorced the first one. It really happened. So as he does that, though, because they're still bound, this is the issue, he does commit adultery because they're still bound. Now, the second half, whoever marries another, that's not correct. Whoever marries her who is divorced, yeah, I put too much up there. That whole phrase is incorrect. Whoever marries really or not really her who is divorced. Well, the question that's said is that this is an after the fact marrying, that something happened up here that then allows this not to be committing adultery. Well, that's not what the verse says. Whoever marries her who is divorced commits adultery. Because she is separated from the one she's bound to. There has been a divorce. And so, one of our earliest studies, we talked about this person who's been put away has no right to marry. We've looked at it a couple of times since then as well. Now, the argument basically says that she's not really put away. But what we've seen today is that she really is put away. What these, all of these let nots and all of these verses we've looked at today are to show that she has been put away. And if she's been put away, then she's the one that's in this situation. And if someone marries her, that is the commission of adultery. God is not saying anything about if the bond has been broken. He's just saying she was divorced. And in fact, that's the reason this becomes adultery. It's because the bond is still there with the one who went away into fornication, if he had put her away. Well, 1 Corinthians says that she would need to remain unmarried or reconcile with the first. 1 Corinthians 7, that she is bound to the one unless she put him away for fornication. The only one who's talked about as having a right to marry another is the one who does the putting away. That's the only one that's mentioned as having a right for another marriage. And it's only by a negative implication. Whoever divorces his wife except for sexual immorality and marries another commits adultery. If you divorce her and it was not sexual immorality, you get married again, you're in adultery. 1 Corinthians 7, you divorce them and don't go get married again. Your only option is to go back to them or you're going to have to stay unmarried. You can't get married again because that would be adultery, which is exactly the same thing Matthew 19 says. In the second half of the equation here, and I'm really sorry that I messed that up because it makes this more difficult now, but down here, he's only talking about the one that was put away. He doesn't say anything about the bond being broken or anything. He says the one who was put away. He doesn't mention the why. It could be either one of those two situations that are there. If you marry the one that's put away, you're committing adultery. That is all we know from the Scripture. That's all the Scripture says on it. It doesn't tell us about, this is why at one point I... This is the all-important word right here. That's why I underlined it before in red. It was an earlier slide we looked at. This is a word that is not in the text. That once this has happened, let's read the whole quote to get it in again. When an innocent woman has been divorced, this is what we're alleging here, divorce was no divorce in the sight of God. They separated the marital relationship, but not the bond. He didn't recognize the bond being broken. I'll give him that, even though he's saying something different. She's still bound in God's sight. The husband who divorced her is still bound to her in God's sight. The marriage has been dissolved. The bond hasn't been. But here's the issue. The marriage hasn't been dissolved, so she hasn't been put away. He's trying to get around the second half. The argument says you marry someone who's been put away, you commit adultery. He can say that here. She's not been put away. In fact, the husband went and committed adultery, so now she can put him away. May then... Okay. Yeah, that's... Exactly. What do we base this teaching on if we don't have any scripture that supports it? All we have is a supposition on the order of the scripture, and again, this invented time clause here, this then she can do it. What I've been trying to contend since the beginning of the study is, if you just read what's written, you can't come up with this argument. This argument is based on some other supposition. Well, I think an example that may help us to see this... I hope it'll help. I want you to think about this. I'll have to leave this with you, and we'll think about it and come back next time to the issue. Supposing the man who did the original divorce, he put her away, But he remains chaste also. That was one of the issues that had come up, one of the things that was talked about there. And she eventually remarries. Can he then put her away scripturally after that? Would it be possible for him to do that because she actually went out and committed adultery, even though he had put her away? Even though he never went, she was the innocent, but then he became the innocent once she committed adultery. Could he then put her away for that adultery? How could he put her away a second time if he already put her away once? The issue is a second putting away. And I think we're looking at the same question. What makes her innocent and him guilty? Those words aren't used. Why is it not that in the case then when he says, well, she committed adultery, that he can't put her away? It's because he's already put her away.